some medicine just to come into the room in our body. Find your seat. Your back is straight. Allow your awareness to come to the crown of your head. And then slowly float down like a mist settling in the valley. As you release and relax any tension that you find, particularly in places where you may hold tension, watch your eyes and your jaw. Shoulders, back of your neck, float down your arms, all the way to the tips of your hands. And then your torso, floating down past your shoulder blades to the small of your back, all the way to your sit bones. Let your belly be soft to receive the full breath. Down your legs, past your knees, to the soles of your feet and the tips of your toes. All your muscles succumb to gravity. Feel the places where your body touches the seat. Hands in your lap or on your legs. Fully embodied. And think, since time without discoverable beginning, we have been born into suffering existence, having to experience all the many sufferings that samsara has to offer. And now we have something special, this precious human life. It's very difficult to meet the teachings of the Buddha. Now that we have, if we don't use them to seek total and complete enlightenment, the best form of liberation from samsara, we'll have to experience all the many sufferings again and again and again. The power to protect us lies in the Guru and the Triple Gem. So in order to reach our highest human potential, that of perfect enlightenment, we're going to engage in these practices and listen to teachings to be able to benefit every living being. Let that be our pole star. We'll see you. Mm-hmm. think about what it means to take refuge. Take refuge with seeking protection, seeking shelter from the suffering of samsara. So when we take refuge, we recite the prayer three times. The first time we recite it, we're thinking about our outer refuge of Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. The second time, we're thinking about our inner refuge, taking refuge in the enlightened mind, taking refuge in seeing emptiness directly, and taking refuge in the Arya beings we have. Our ultimate refuge is to take refuge with confidence that the nature of our own mind is wisdom. Its expression is clarity, and its compassion is all-pervasive. So if we can hold that in our thoughts as we recite the refuge prayer three times in English. I go for refuge into enlightenment, to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, by my virtuous actions of giving and so on. May I become a Buddha to benefit all beings. I go for refuge until enlightenment, to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, by my virtuous actions of giving and so on. May I become a Buddha to benefit all beings. I go for refuge until enlightenment, to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, by my virtuous actions of giving and so on. May I become a Buddha to benefit all beings. May all beings have equanimity, free of attachment and aversion. May all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all beings be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. May all beings find the rebirth and the bliss of liberation. So then we do a bless. This request of blessing is to request realizations of the entire path to enlightenment. May we be inspired by the good devotion, uplifted by the preciousness of this human life, shed the fetters of attachment and aversion through a knowledge of impermanence, be protected by refuge, guided by a knowledge of actions and their results, aim for liberation through renunciation. May we be motivated by bodhicitta, opened by giving, disciplined by ethical behavior, strengthened by patience, enthused by joyous effort, stabilized by concentration, and free by wisdom. So this evening, I had an idea to tell you about Lama Yeshe, founder. So I have a little slideshow, photographs of him, and so I thought we would start with that. Yes, ma'am?
Could you speak up a little bit?
Yes.
Oh, do you want to have the microphone now?
Thank you for asking.
I think if you spoke just a little louder, it would be fine as well.
Yeah, I think I'll do this because sometimes it's more difficult to
turn it.
Okay, how about like that?
Yeah.
All right.
I happen to be next to the speaker.
Always nice. Okay.
Oh, just push the arrow button.
So this is Lama. Lama Thupten Yeshe. I think he's the founder of the Foundation for the Preservation of the Mahayana Tradition, the FPMT. And so we're just going through and tell you a few stories. This is where I met Lama at, in This is a retreat in Yucca Valley, California in 1977. And this is where Lama Yeshe and Lama Yoko Rinpoche, it was their, actually it was their third visit to the United States. All of these people were there. And we had, at that time, one of the students at the end gave this very inspiring talk. We must build a retreat center. So there were two students in that retreat that offered 30 acres of land in the Santa Cruz Mountains. They called their partners and said, could we give 30 of our 80 acres? And the partner says, yes. So that's when Vajrapani Institute for Wisdom Culture was born. And my former husband and I were the first two on land, and this is where we lived. There were others who came as well. Some built canvas houses, just stick frame and put canvas on. Some carpet houses. We had dumpsters. Went to San Jose to the big carpet, like carpet warehouse, because behind there they would have these big dumpsters that had, they would tear out the big industrial buildings of carpets that were in fine shape, and they were tacked to the walls. That was the wall. With windows. Very interesting. So when it started to rain, this was in, we moved into this teepee in May of 1977. And when it started to rain in the fall, we built a small, it was called the Jackson Kitchen. It was a small one room. And in it, we had a wood cook stove. And this was a picture of me cooking Thanksgiving dinner in 1977.
Did you have your kids then?
Yes, I had two children then. Mm-hmm. If you go on to the next picture, you will be able to see that there were many children at the Vajrapani Institute. They had it was really a fun place for the kids to grow up because they mostly were outside and playing with one another. And they had, do you know what a big wheel is?
Mm-hmm.
You know, a great big wheel in front with the two small ones. So all of them, for the most part, had a big wheel or a little wheel. Just my 2-year-old had a little wheel. And they would take these to the top of these hills and just put their feet up and run down. It was
amazing.
With
no helmet?
Oh, no helmet. 1977?
Yeah. Nobody wore helmets.
Nobody wore helmets in 1977. And they didn't fall off. I don't think there was any major accidents. This is the inside of the Jackson Kitchen in 1978. And seated, the Lama with the beard is Kyabje Songer, which is a very highly revered Lama. And of course, we were just a bunch of hippies. And he was giving us Vajrapani Hayagriva Garuda initiation, and we had no idea what that was. But there were also several other lamas there, as you can see. And Tsongkhapa Rinpoche had been asked by Lama Yeshe to come to America and teach his students. And he agreed, but then sometime later he said, you know, I don't think you really need someone of this caliber. He didn't say it like that, but I think maybe one of the younger Geshe's could probably go. And Lama said, oh, but you promised. So, okay. And when he went back, he told Lama, he said, it's good that I went. He said, because Westerners, he says, they ask a lot of hard questions. And I was told later by a monk who Mal Lucet, beside Vajrapani, that who was in Tsong Rinpoche's monastery. And one day when they were having an offering ceremony, a Guru Puja they call it, there's a place in that puja where they stop and everybody gets tea and they pass out snacks and then they tell stories. And so Tsong Rinpoche said, Duke Dinyeshi asked me to go to California to teach his students, and he said, Duke Dinyeshi calls them the bushy people. He said, no, I think, he says, they're very sincere, and I think they will find the path. So this monk, who is not a monk now, he's actually married to the daughter of one of the donors of the land, and lives right down the road from me, came to Vajrapani then. And he said, when he heard that, he always wanted to go to Vajrapani.
Did he call you bushy people because you lived in the woods, or because you lived in the
woods? Both, I believe. Because look at them all.
Yeah.
Lama's appeal was his enormous vitality. He just oozed life. He was a living example of the vast potential of human consciousness, advising that that was everybody's birthright. We'll be going.
Okay.
Several levels, so I'll just say a few words and then we'll just go through them. These pictures were taken at the majority of them were taken at Vajrapani Institute. The Lama had such warmth and abundance of joy and overwhelming humanity and an incredible intellect. When he made three prostrations, snapped his fingers and climbed onto his seat, rolled his mala in his palms, he would look at us and then he would burst out laughing almost every day. He was so full of joy. Well, did we skip one? Yeah.
Okay,
right? Yes. So I was Lama's secretary for one summer, and every Friday the moms and kids would go to Seabright Beach, and then the man who had been doing construction work would show up in the afternoon. And Lama came once, and you saw that next one. He was just a riot. He was doing his Muscle Beach impersonation. And we had a blow-up mattress. You know what those are? Those, you know, they look like. And Lama got on that and was going to ride the waves on that. And he didn't know how to swim. So the guys were right by him, kind of walking around. His mom was just laughing, and then it lost air. So Lama used every aspect of life to teach. Enjoy as much as possible, dear, he would say, without grasping. And he would say, thank you, thank you, thank you so much. No matter whether you were playing in the sand or whether you were listening to teachings, he was always thanking students. He would just say, thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Someone asked him, how can Tibetan Buddhism be integrated into normal, everyday Western life? And Lama said, each must just do according to his or her own level. He said, Dharma was like an American bed. Everyone could fit in. He was, you know, king size bed. I mean, hello. He was like an anthropologist studying us. Yeah. You can see just so many expressions on his face, yeah. His principal aim in life was to reach out to all people. In Hong Kong, he took off his robes and put on a suit and tie and went to a nightclub in his hotel because he wanted to see for himself what Westerners considered excellent entertainment. So you need to go back, 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 back. Okay. Yep. Go to the next one. The one where he has his hand up. Okay. Now you can go one more. Yeah. So when he was in Australia, he donned shorts and a t-shirt, put on a big sun hat, and went on a walkabout. And he didn't tell anyone where he was going, so for about a week he was gone. And when he came back, he said he went to the beach, because that's what, obviously, Australians thought was good, having a good time. He always told people to have a good time.
No, I'm just unsure how I'm going to change it. So.
Okay. I'll just go like that.
Okay.
So in America, he astonished not just a few by playing the tables in Las Vegas, and he went to Disneyland. There's actually a video on YouTube that was recently shared. It's priceless. He had such a good time in Disneyland, going on rides. And Lhasa Borchia wasn't with him that day. But when he went back, he told him he had to go. So the next day, some of the students took Lhasa Borchia. Lhasa Borchia didn't want to go. But he went. And maybe he had a good time. Anyway, he did go. Lhasa just laughed and had such a good time. In San Francisco, he asked to be taken to a gay bar. And he went to the gay pride parade and really was fascinated by that. He had a good time there. He had no judgment. He just had a thirst for understanding and knowledge, trying to see who people were, how he could help. He took an active interest in politics. He would watch television. And he liked to watch the ads, because he said that the ads would show the psychology of people, what it was, the minds of people in a different country. Whenever he had an opportunity, he liked to visit Christian monasteries and talk to the monks there. He was an ecumenicist. He loved gardening, cooking, and driving. He loved to drive. He got his driver's license. And anyone who rode with him was terrified. Because he liked to go fast. And he would go fast. And he was pulled over by highway patrol. And as he was receiving his ticket, he was saying, "Thank you, thank you so much, thank you." But some of the students tell stories about him and his just going so fast, getting off the freeway really fast. He was born in May of 1935 in a mountainous village not far from Lhasa, and his parents were farmers. There was a lama who was famed for his psychic powers, and the nuns at Chime Lung Gampa learned that Lama Yeshe was the incarnation of their abbess, who was a great yogini with high spiritual attainments. The nunnery was close to Lama's house, and so the nuns would often take him back to the nunnery, where he would sit with them and have new prayers, preaching, offering ceremonies. He loved being with them. He was very happy in their company. He wanted to lead a religious life, and when he was six, his parents allowed him to go to Sera Monastery near Lhasa, where he studied for 12 years. But he didn't sit for the Geshe exam. Joking to his uncle, he said, "Are you kidding?" He said, "Have he called Geshe Yeshe?" Ridiculous. But he actually told his uncle that the money that would be spent benefacting his exams would be better spent as offerings to feeding the poor. And instead, he went into a three-year retreat. In 1959, the Chinese invasion forced Lama to India, along with many, many other Tibetans, to Buxador. Lama said it was a big shock. He said, "I thought I had gone to hell." In Tibet, it's cold. In India, it's so hot. So hot. There, he studied English, and it was 2 years later that he met Lama Zobor, who was sent to him for tutelage. And in 1965, Zina Rachevsky, a beautiful Russian princess who'd been traveling to the pleasure spots in India, like the beaches in Goa, and finding no satisfaction, she came to Rinpoche and Lama and said, "How can I receive peace?" So she studied with them, asked for ordination, and eventually she was the one who purchased the property where Kopan Monastery was established in Nepal, on the hill overlooking Bodnar. She died young. She died in 1942 of hepatitis. And maybe you heard the story of Padmasambhava's prediction, where he said his prediction was, "When iron birds fly and horses run on wheels, Tibetan people will be scattered like ants across the face of the earth, and the Dharma will come to the land of the red skins." I get goosebumps. And that, in fact, did happen. Trains and planes. Coming out of a closed world, Buddhism encountered fresh questioning ears in the West. Lama loved questions. He was very happy that students asked questions. As a matter of fact, when people, some other lamas that would be with him, said, "Your students are disrespectful." He said, "No." He said, "They're very intelligent. They're trying to get to the bottom of things, because Tibetans just accept whatever. They're trained in that way, to just accept whatever's being taught." So in this case, the Westerners would debate Lama. The other Lamas thought that they were being disrespectful. So Westerners began flocking to Kopan, and the November month-long Lam Rim course swelled to over 250 students, and it's still happening today. Every November, there is a month-long Lam Rim, Stages of Path retreat at Kopan. Primarily led by Western Sangha, Western ordained, usually Venerable Annie Karen, but oftentimes others. And Lama Zopa Rinpoche usually arrives the last week. And that's always a great excitement when Rinpoche arrives. I haven't been. Have any of you been to Kopan? I might have had my fill of Asia last January. So I met the Lamas on their third visit to the U.S. in Yucca Valley, where the Vajrayana Retreat Center was born. Lama was really instrumental in bringing Buddhism to the West. He said, "The time is right for Buddhism to come to the West. There's so much mental suffering in the West. Maybe because you have so much physical comfort. The monkey mind has to find something to occupy itself. But it's the essence of Buddhism that must be brought over. The essence must be brought over. He was very keen to have Buddhism translated into Western language with Western ideas, Western examples, so that Westerners could taste it, could touch it, could understand it. And many of the Geshe's who are teaching in Western centers now are doing just that. They're teaching in a much more modern way so that Westerners can touch it. I heard just last weekend that there is a new book out. It's His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Thupten Chodron. Have you seen it? Have you? Yeah. It's a new way of presenting the stages of the path, and I understand it's to be 3 or 4 volumes. So definitely want to get that and look at how it
is. I think we're going to study it next summer when Geshe Sultram comes.
Wonderful.
Because it's been out in Tibetan for like a year maybe, and it's just now being translated to English.
Great. Yeah. So it's curious. It's curious to me how they're going to determine what stages it will be offered in. Because when lamas come, the Tibetan lamas come, they don't usually start with the first stage of guru devotion because Westerners can't get that. They just can't get that. So that comes much later. Anyway, it's very interesting.
I have the book, the first volume is on the physical world, and it describes things from the Dharma Kosha.
Cool.
And it doesn't seem to be set up like long room.
Yeah, I heard it's not. That it's meant to include all of the long room, but it's set up to be a methodology for teaching Westerners.
Oh, that makes sense. That would be like scientific.
Yes.
And the second volume it says is about the mind.
Yes, I think it's going to be very interesting. Yeah, very interesting. So Lama advised that when we begin to study Buddhism and take refuge in Buddha Dharma, the most important point that we have then recognized our own profound human potential. When we take refuge, we're saying, yeah, I can do something. I can't. As we can see, I can do something. I can take responsibility for liberating myself. Lama explained that this is different from the attitude we normally have. I'm hopeless. Maybe God, maybe Buddha, maybe Lama can do something for me. This sort of human attitude is wrong because it's not true. The important thing in taking refuge is to have the understanding that you can do something to solve the problems of everyday life by relying with confidence and trust in the Buddha's wisdom. You can call on your own activated wisdom to liberate you from confusion. So it's really worthwhile. The real significance of taking refuge in Dharma wisdom is that it is the entrance to the path to enlightenment. In 1984, Lama died from congestive heart failure in Cedars-Sinai Hospital in Los Angeles. His holy body was brought to Vajrapani Institute, where a traditional Tibetan cremation took place. The cremation stupa was constructed on what is now called Lama's Ridge. His holy body was placed inside. In the traditional manner, he was encased inside walls of brick and mortar. Then it was whitewashed, all done in just a few hours. The fire was lit by a woman who had never met Lama, as is the tradition. And today, there are 4 stupas on that site, Vajrapani students preserved the base and erected a stupa on top, surrounded by three Kadampa stupas, all filled with prayers, incense, and holy relics. It's a site of pilgrimage. And there, you can sort of see behind the prayer flag on the side, a small cabin. That, and then there's another one a little further down. That's the ridge. And it is one, and two. Mm-hmm. There are seven retreat cabins up on that ridge where people can do solitary retreat. They're nice little cabins, just one room. And lunch is brought. And lunch and dinner is brought. And there's breakfast available. So it's a really beautiful sight with some, to the right, there's a view. So in February 1985, Lama Yeshe's reincarnation was born in Spain to Lama's Western students, Maria and Paco Hita Torres. His name was Oso Hita Torres.
Was that one of the golden?
Yes, that was, with his crocheted hat. Oso was recognized by his holiness as Lama's reincarnation and taken to Sera Monastery when he was just 14 months old. His father went with him, and when he was 18, he asked permission to leave. He left the monastery with a great wish to become a filmmaker. And he's an avid drummer, has a great love of life, and occasionally gives Dharma talks. And this is his wife, Mila. This is his son, just recently born. I think he might be about 6 months old now. His name is Tenzin Norgay. That was a shot taken just when he was a few minutes old. Lama Yeshe insisted that the essence of Tibetan Buddhism must be related to Western psychology, Western science, and philosophy. So otherwise, there's no connection. And actually, this is not such a difficult job, he said, because the major Buddhist teachings, such as the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, emptiness, and bodhicitta, are all extremely logical and practical. They apply to people of all times, because they deal with fundamental human nature and issues of suffering and happiness. So I'll stop right here. I just thought it would be interesting for me to see Lama's life. Great fun putting it together.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. So the reincarnations of the great Lamas don't necessarily teach.
Necessarily.
Do they usually?
Not. Well, it depends. You know, actually, this is kind of the degenerate times, right? So there are other incarnate lamas that are not teaching, they've decided to go a Western way. And there are incarnations that are doing things in a different way, you know, not in the traditional monastic way. But it is interesting. It is very interesting. Oso is very, it's fun to listen to him teach. I recently went to Los Angeles to see Soma Rinpoche's incarnation teach. So this was the Lama that was in the picture.
Mm-hmm.
And he's now, I think he's early 30s, and he's been through all the training in the monastery, and he's remarkable.
And he's very interested in, he taught in English. He's very interested in vocabulary. So he wants people in the audience to tell him if there's a better word. And he's got a big vocabulary. It's quite amazing. So he's still got 2 more years of Geshe studies. Has a center that's been given to him in Germany. So he'll spend quite a bit of time there, I'm sure. But he comes to Los Angeles to Thupten-Darkey Lake, which is Geshe Gyaltsen's center. So it's fun to see that. I'm old enough to be able to take teachings from 2 generations. Amazing. And it was fun to go to Los Angeles to Thupten-Darkey Lake and hear his holiness. Because there were probably 20 people in the room that had been with me and studying from his incarnation before. So that was amazing. To have continued the thread, right, through the whole life, continue to receive teachings and then receive teachings from the incarnation. So maybe we'll take we started at 6:30, that's right. You see, I have a tendency to go over, and then you don't get any breaks. So let's take a tea break. Yeah, I remember. I said I'm going to be back. You remember, yes, I'll be back.
Yes.
I'll be back.
And then we're starting an 8-week Compassionate Communication Foundations course, and it starts on the 30th? November 30th, and that is Thursdays. And that's going to go take us into the end of January next year. And if you can come throughout and make what you can, or is it?
We're going to build from the beginning, so it's, what I'd ask is to hold the intention of coming. Life happens, and it's not possible, but as much as you can. We pair people up with buddies so they can practice.
Cool.
Come if you can.
We are skipping the 28th of December.
So what's going to happen is next Monday we'll meet, the 20th, and then the 28th, yeah, we'll skip that one, which is a Thursday. Mm-hmm. So we'll meet next Monday, and then we'll meet on the 30th after that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and if you guys haven't been to Sunil's Compassionate Communication courses, or for me, I guess it's been really powerful the way he teaches compassionate communication, which is based on the nonviolent communication model. And for me, it's been very helpful of taking my Buddhist practice and then actually applying it out to the world through my speech and through my communication. So I highly recommend it. If you're curious, Sunil's here tonight and he's one leading, so you can ask him questions. And then David Drabble, who left at the break, he's starting a meditation course on the 4 measurables, which is equanimity, joy, compassion, and love. And so that is going to start this Thursday, and then it's a kind of a funky switch that we're doing. So we're starting this Thursday the 16th, they're off next week, and then it's going to resume on Mondays for the next couple of weeks. But it's a really sweet practice to do around the holidays, especially. It's a very it's a heart-opening practice, which is really nice during this time of year. So if you're interested in learning about that, David's been studying meditation and Tibetan Buddhism for a long time, so he's really knowledgeable. And then in December, we're going to continue to have classes. Ami Diller, our spiritual director, will be back end of November, and she's going to be teaching December 12th. And Jay is going to be doing music for us on December 19th, which is up Tuesday. So, and then we're having a monk coming from the Ganden Monastery at the end of January, and it's a lot of organizing. While they're here, they're doing home blessings, office blessings, a bunch of different events. And so if you're interested in helping with that, Pamela is leading the organizational charge with that, and she would love your help. It could be anything from planning ahead of time to actually in the moment, I can come to this event and open doors, like that kind of stuff. So there's a sign-up list right here that I will pass around with a pen in a moment. So if you're available to help, we're getting a list started, and it's going to be really cool. So, yeah. Am I forgetting anything?
Do we have spots in the retreat still?
I'm not sure. At last I heard that it was all full. Sorry, this is a really important announcement. So on Friday is our homeless breakfast. We serve 200 homeless people, or people who are homeless, at Friendship Park in downtown. And I think they still need food. So if you are interested in participating, we need food donations and perhaps service donations. Typically, we more often need food. So if you're interested, we need things like hard-boiled eggs, cheese sticks, stuff like that. And so, you know, you can get 150 hard-boiled eggs for about $15 this morning sign up. So if you're interested, talk to me and I can give you information. And we also serve breakfast on Sundays. And then finally, we are a completely donation-based organization. And so there's donables in the back that helps us pay for our rent and also support our teachers so she can come and teach us and keep coming back and teaching.
Purifying those thoughts, actions, words, where we make mistakes, we wish we had not. It's through the power of meditation that we are able to mind our actions on the street, in our office. When we sit, we have an opportunity. When we sit, in the beginning, it's difficult. Because we're not used to subduing our mind. We're not used to being still, particularly in this day and age. Now, so difficult. Be quiet, to be still. Always when you have a moment while somebody's running into the post office, checking. Sometimes you're checking and checking again. There's some kind of attachment, some kind of strong tether to information. Like we're going to miss something if we don't check. I've been thinking a lot about this because I find myself, I'll forget my phone and I'll put it and I just won't take it with me accidentally. And then I'll realize, wow, now I'm not going to be able to call, tell them I'm see if they need anything. How dependent we have become. When I first came out of long retreat, it was, I'd been in retreat from 2010 to 2014. And technology in that time, I did have a phone when I went into retreat, but it was one of those flip phones. And when I came out of retreat, I remember seeing something about, it was Ellen DeGeneres talking about the best selfie ever. And I thought, what's a selfie? I didn't even know what a selfie was. So much of this, there's been so much change with technology, and I'm seeing young people today, very young, teenagers, even younger, living with their face in their phone. I don't know what they're doing. Playing games, probably. But at some point in time, we have to unplug in order to be able to subdue our mind, to be able to see the gap between the thoughts. You know, there's this sign in the subway in London that says, mind the gaps. As you're getting ready to step on the train, mind the gaps. It's very difficult to mind the gaps in your meditation. It's very difficult to settle without a consistent practice, without sitting every day. And when you do, there's something alchemical that takes place. You have a, it's like brushing your teeth. If you don't brush your teeth, you just don't feel right. But if you sit every day, then you don't feel right if you don't. And Lama used to say, meditation, we want to be happy. This is our goal in life. This is everyone's goal. Everything we do is predicated on the wish to be happy. If you look from underneath it all, it's what we wish, is to be happy. Happiness, defined by Webster, is a state of well-being, contentment. So it is a lack of wanting. If you check when you're wanting something or wanting not to have something, some circumstance in your life that you wish didn't exist, that you were wanting, and then when that circumstance changes, you're happy. You believe that your happiness is in the circumstance. You believe that your happiness is in the object that you got. Want it. Because when you get it, coincidentally, you're happy in that moment. So it feels like happiness is in the object. We're hungry, we want food, we eat. We think the happiness and satisfaction is in the food. It happens on a very subtle level on many, many things throughout our day because we are reifying all of the things in our life. But truly, happiness, that contentment, that state of well-being, comes from no longer wanting. In that moment when you get what you want, you're not wanting. When you're free from what you don't want, you're not wanting. So accepting what is, whether it is what you want or what you don't want. Master Shantideva used to say, if there's something that you can do about the circumstance, why worry? If there's nothing you can do about the circumstance, why worry? So in other words, it's a matter of making choices that will bring happiness to yourself and others. If we look at what they are, if we look at states of mind that are happy states of mind, involves not thinking so much about what I want. When you talk about giving, the practice of generosity, how nice you feel when you give someone something and bring them joy. There's a warmth in your heart. When you're rejoicing in something good somebody else did, instead of wishing you had it yourself, being able to rejoice is a wonderful state of mind. I was thinking, when we do these practices, just like prayers, when we take refuge and we are thinking about our teacher, we're thinking about the Buddha, we have gratitude. If we have gratitude in our heart, we think when we say these prayers, if we open our hearts, if we actually look at what is it that the prayer is saying to us, when we say, I go for refuge to the Buddha, we're remembering what he did in order to reach a state of enlightenment over countless lifetimes practicing as a bodhisattva. But we know how hard it is to sit on our cushion for 30 minutes. So to do the work necessary to reach a state of perfect enlightenment is admirable. And to have done that and then to be able to teach us, how great. So we have gratitude. And the mindset of gratitude is really peaceful and happy and heart-healthy. And if you look at the four immeasurables, may all beings have equanimity. There's something in our own mind that is happy when we make that wish. If we just think about it, we say, may all beings have equanimity, free from the bias of attachment and hatred. How wonderful it will be when they have that. I'll take responsibility for that. I'm getting goosebumps just thinking about that. How beautiful it would be in this world if the four immeasurable thoughts, which David is going to be, you just mentioned, is going to be leading meditations on, if they were actualized, how wonderful that would be. So the point of meditation, the point of practice, is to be happy. It's not to go, oh, now I have to go sit on my cushion. Really? But if our practice is not bringing us happiness, it needs to be tweaked. We need to do it differently. Think about it differently. Because it is happy making if we're attending to it. If we're just sitting down to recite the prayers, you know, we read the prayers, if we just do it as Geshe Lama Tsongcho said, if you're reciting the prayers from your lips, it's useless. You must recite from your heart. So few prayers with a mind attending to the meaning is much better than 45 minutes of recitation where your mind is actually making the rosary list while you're saying the words. His Holiness, I remember once that I heard him say, no, I'm not sure if just reciting prayer is that much better. Something like that. So I think about how it is that happiness comes from doing these practices and why it is that it's true. Why is it that it's true? What do you think? Why do you think it's true? What is it in your practice? Can you think in your practice, in your daily practice? Have you seen in your practice where you may have gone to your cushion as grumpy and come out as happy? Has that happened to you? Why do you think that's true? I'm looking at both of you. She's right behind you. She's like, yes, too.
Partly because I'm not thinking about myself the whole time on my cushion, I think.
Mm-hmm.
for me, I don't know why I'm getting so emotional. It's imagining my teacher looking at me with the unconditional love and just feeling that warmth. And then, especially when it could be so hard for me to feel that love for myself.
Yes.
I'm still feeling it from my teacher. It's really powerful.
Yeah. And that is. That's the blessing of the teacher. Yeah. But it doesn't come from the teacher, you see. It comes from you. It comes from your faith and your devotion. So if it came from the teacher, then everyone would have that same exact response to that same teacher. So the more we think about with gratitude in our hearts to the teacher who has given us this information, this practice that is going to save our life. It's like, wow. And when I think about it, I think about my lamas. That's what they've done their whole life. It's just go around and teach. They've just taught. They've just given. Whatever. Not thinking about themselves. Anybody else?
I think there's also the power of everyone who's done these same practices before.
Power of the lineage.
Yeah, and maybe people who are doing them at the same time mm-hmm. currently. And then also doing them over and over every day mm-hmm. builds up something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. There's a. I haven't been using it lately, but there's an insight timer in an application you can use on your phone. And when you turn it on, it shows you how many people around the world are meditating with you right now using that. To be hit. So that is, sometimes when I've seen that, I've gone, oh, fantastic. So fantastic. All over the world. All over the world. So that gives support, that gives courage.
Mm. Like sometimes I think from a science perspective, I know it takes about 20 minutes physiologically. Switch from fight or flight or like any kind of anxiety. I think just our normal operating busy mode, really, that has become habituated to be normal, takes just 20 minutes of just like sitting and resting to switch into rest and digest. So sometimes I think if I can't think of anything else, is there any other reason to get on cushion? Which is why I'll just shift and give myself 20 minutes to settle.
I think that my experience of being in the world a lot since I came out of retreat, doing a lot of for the first year I was pretty not busy, and then I became more busy teaching and working at Vajrapani Institute. And this summer I worked there for 7 weeks every day. Sunday, undergrounding utilities, and I was helping with that. And so every day, all day, and I realized that when you are going to work every day, all day, 5-6 days a week, it's more difficult to set. Takes some time. But I do believe what you say, Maya, is true. That if you sit, and you're making a determination to sit, you are actually Lama used to say, strong determination. That when you sit down, you first relax, there's a prescription. There is a prescription to create a mind that's fertile enough to do the prayers, even to begin. And just to come in from a busy moment and sit on your cushion and think that you can begin to settle your mind without relaxing and doing some breathing meditation, really being present, thinking about your lungs, that's one of the best ways to give you the courage to do your practice well, is imagining that they're here. You do, when you take refuge, and we didn't do it tonight, but usually one will, and on Saturday we'll be doing full meditation, so we'll be doing it in a different way. But you really imagine your lama in front of you as the Buddha, and you just imagine them completely in love with you, smiling and happy that you're doing this practice. So if you start there, and then you're making offerings to them, please, I'm offering you everything, bless my mind. And then you receive the blessing, and it's like a powerful shower of bliss, because I believe that there's that energy is out there in the universe, and it will arrive, and it will bless you. You just have to be present to receive it, awake and aware, and settling. Settling, yeah. And 20 minutes? Yeah. Within 20 minutes, probably you can settle well. Yeah. What is it that gets in the way of practice? Yes, what?
What we assume are responsibilities. I have to, I should, I need, I have to. Got it?
What is it, dear? Show you the entire path to enlightenment. Whether you are enlightened or not is totally up to you. Rupa Rinpoche said, the Lama can't throw you up to enlightenment like tossing a pebble. And the work has to be done by ourselves. Each one of us has to do the work ourselves. And sometimes, yes?
When you asked that question, then I responded, and I just very quickly got that one thing that gets in my way is I want to continue to be right.
That you want to
that I want to continue to be right. That's what. But it's like I want to meditate because I'm okay. I just want to fester.
You're okay where you are now, and you don't want to meditate. I'm not sure what you mean by you want to be right.
Instead of being compassionate and going to a place of meditating and quieting the mind to put you in a better place of being compassionate to others or myself or to a situation, I consciously or subconsciously am choosing to stay in suffering, stay in a space of suffering.
Mm-hmm. I hear you. Mm-hmm. Isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. You look at that, don't you find that interesting?
Is that a desire then to be a victim? Is it suffering that you're choosing? I'm trying to understand. I'm sorry.
Well, you know when you're irritated with someone? Have you ever been irritated with anyone?
It happened today.
So, and you feel right in your irritation.
Yeah. Right. Empowered.
Yeah. So it's, I think maybe it's kind of like that, that you have a sense of self-righteousness, really. Yeah.
Superiority.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is, that's ego grasping. I mean, that is really what it is. It's grasping onto the one that we believe truly exists, that is right. And that one doesn't exist at all, the way we believe they do. She does. I don't exist at all the way I believe I do. You know, I believe that I'm more than just this five aggregates, you know, more than just body-mind. You know, there's some kind of Oz in there that's pulling the strings and running the show. If you look to try to find who you are, and this is an ongoing lifetime meditation of finding who you are, and you find that you do not exist in the way that you believe that you do, but nonetheless, there's a very strong sense when we either really want something badly, you know, we desire something really badly, or we don't like. You know, irritation has arisen. And there's a very strong sense that we're right to want those things or to not want those things, whichever it is. But Buddha tells us that these are empty of the qualities that we should want or not want, and that we're just placing that on them. Okay, so if that's true, how are we going to get around that? It's only through the power of looking at the mind that we begin to whittle away at this one that we think exists, or to be able to see how it is that we could, in fact, give the victory to the person who's irritating us. Irritation is a very uncomfortable state of mind. To be grumbling about somebody's behavior. And it doesn't feel good. It's not like, oh, you know, I love you. It's not like that. It's like, ugh. And that's not pleasant. So if we want to be happy, we need to be free from that irritation. How do we get free from that irritation? Tell me, how do we get free from that irritation? What would you do if you had decided to be free of that? What would you do?
Let it go.
And how would you be able to do that?
By engaging in the process of letting go.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So through the breath, just saying, I'm going to let this go. Or just saying to yourself, I'm going to let this go.
Or through the mind. And maybe saying, I'm going to expand my mind beyond this.
Okay. So you see that you are not the irritation. You can get beyond that. You can go out beyond that. Mm-hmm, that's a good way. If there's a particular person in your life who irritates you on a regular basis, how would you deal with that? How could you get beyond that? You have to see that person every day, and their behavior irritates you.
I think meditations on equanimity are helpful.
I think you're right. Yes. And in the very moment, were you going to say something?
No.
Me?
Yeah.
I'm thinking, but not.
I was going to say that my experience of putting the teachings into practice on my feet is actually taking the irritating person, and neutralizing them by thinking that actually not everybody is irritated by them doing that. So if the irritation is coming from my mind, how can I be kind to that person and like that person more? So I try to find positive qualities in that person. It's just by telling yourself, oh, you know, they often bring donuts. You know, that's so sweet. You know, whatever it is that they do, trying to find some positive quality. They do this and this and this and this and this, and it's so good. Instead of what we typically do when someone is irritating us, is that we take that and we put it in the basket of irritation, and then we think about all the times they've irritated us in the past. And probably they're going to do it in the future, and we put those in there too. And then we carry this around. And then they come up to us and they say, oh, that's such a beautiful sweater. And you can't take it in because you've got too much garbage in here.
Loving kindness practice can sometimes help. But it's a lot of work, though.
It is.
Get through the irritation, but
it is.
It can be very sweet when there's enough.
It is. It's true. It is a lot of work to change our mind because we've been thinking like this since time without discoverable beginning. We came into this life thinking that things existed in a solid, concrete way. So we're whittling away at that. And the way to do that is through the power of sitting meditation. And the various and sundry practices that we have, like loving kindness meditation, all the mind training techniques that we have that we can use. And my experience is that if you try them once and they work, because they do work, it's like, wow. You can, by giving the victory to others, I remember that when I first heard the 7-point mind training, and I heard that you should, when someone harms you, you should give the victory to them. Namgyal Rinpoche taught this in the late 70s. And I thought, really? But shortly thereafter, I had an opportunity to put it into practice. And I couldn't believe how it worked. I really couldn't believe that I did. Back when we had all these children and we took turns taking them to school. So it's 20 minutes into town down the dirt road. And we had one car. It was a big four-wheel drive car. And so on the day that it was your turn to take the kids to school, you would typically do your laundry and buy your groceries and anything else you wanted to do. So it was my day to take the car. And I had to walk for 10 minutes to get to the car. So walking and getting to the car's not there. So I realized that somebody else had taken the car. And so I was irritated. And I thought, well, if I'm going to follow the advice of Lanza Rinpoche, I'll give the victory to her. So when she came back, instead of being mad at her, I just said, oh, great. I thought I was supposed to take the car today, but I guess I'm going to take it tomorrow. But I didn't say it any. You took the car and I was supposed to have it. She says, oh, really? Yeah, you were supposed to have the car today. I'm so sorry. But I think if I would have come at her like a ton of bricks, which is what I wanted to do initially, then it would have been a different scenario. So having the occasion to try that from time to time, just try it and see what happens. Because having sandpaper in your relationship with someone is very uncomfortable. So if you just give it up, sometimes when you say, oh, you're absolutely right, you know, I hadn't thought of it like that. And then oftentimes they'll come back with, well, you know, maybe I'm not 100% right, or maybe it's you're right too, and you come to some neutrality. It often happens that way. Instead of entrenching yourself in the I'm right, I'm right.
And you're like, no, I don't want to be right. I'm letting you be right.
Yeah.
How dare you?
Yeah. So it's a practice. It's an ongoing practice. And on Saturday, I want to do a practice that we will, that is, was done. It was a practice taught by Master Tolopa to his heart son, Naropa. And it is called Ganji Mahmuda. And it's a very profound practice. It's 28 verses, which we'll simply will meditate to. These 28 verses. And it helps you to begin to be aware of awareness itself. So it's mind looking at mind. And it helps you get to that place of mind looking at mind. Instead of having your object of meditation be a prayer or your breath, this is mind. Your object of meditation is mind. It's awareness. So you're using the mind, looking at your mind. I came across this text when I was in a long retreat and used it for the last year of my retreat and found it quite good. it's excellent. So we're going to do that at that time. So I think maybe for now we could maybe do a little meditation for 10 minutes. You to imagine your Lama before you in the aspect of the Buddha. If you haven't met your heart Lama yet, you can imagine His Holiness the Dalai Lama or any other individual who represents the highest good for you. And just see that they have transformed themselves into this golden light body. Smiling at you like a father for their only child. Already taken refuge and generated the mind of enlightenment. Make a promise to your Lama Buddha. Make a promise that you will in fact, for sure, reach a state of perfect enlightenment. And when you do, you will liberate every living being without exception. And ask for their blessing to be able to actualize this great wish. Imagine that they have a strong desire to help you, and that they melt into a small sphere of light exercise in the robin thing, which comes to the crown of your head. And slowly begins to descend down through the center of your body until it comes to rest. This sphere of light is in the nature of love, compassion, and wisdom. And it begins to expand and to fill your body. Warm, radiating light, blissful, joyful energy. It's uncontainable. And it passes through all your pores, in all directions, and begins to touch all sentient beings. Imagine that in your mind's eye, that all beings receive exactly what they need. Go to the people you know who are ill. Give them your love. Go to the countries that are torn by war, famine, floods, fires. Soothe them. And then imagine that these rays begin to condense back and everything is dissolving into its true nature, which is bliss and emptiness. It comes back, becoming smaller and smaller. And everything you thought you were is dissolving into this small sphere of light. And you watch it as it becomes completely imperceivable. And you rest there. State of non-conceptuality. Let whatever appears in the mind be just like a dream. Feed or strangle whatever appears.
There's nothing to do. Nothing to undo. And once again, crystallize your body into this bodhisattva body. And we dedicate the positive energy that we've created. That we might become Buddhas quicker than quick, without delay of even a second. We make a strong determination to use this life for the welfare of ourselves and all others. May the bodhicitta which has grown in our mind continue to grow and never diminish. And where it has not yet arisen, may it rise and grow. May all our spiritual teachers teaching valid paths to enlightenment live long and fruitful lives.